Thanks to Ghazal for the invitation. And although I trained as a mathematical physicist, the next 25 years of my career, I more or less did mathematics. And it's relatively recently that I've come back into doing things that touch on physics a little bit. So it's really, I'm glad to have an opportunity to hear from physicists. There's a version of the talk on my website if you click on talk two in case you want to see the slides. What's the story? So, I mean, of course, Einstein's theory of gravity is set in a world of smooth Lorentzian manifolds, but we also know that in many circumstances, the smoothness has to break down. So there are these Hawking and Penrose theorems that say if you go back, you know, 13.5 billion years, you run into a singularity, or if you fall into a black hole, you run into a singularity. And so it would be very desirable, at least from my point of view, to have a non-smooth theory of gravity that maybe allows you to give a more rigorous treatment of what's going on around some of these singularities. And there's kind of a model for this in the positive signature case that goes back about 100 years to the Russian school, or 80 years anyways, to the Russian school of Alexandrov, who figured out how you can define sectional curvature bounds in a metric space setting as long as you have geodesics and can do comparison between triangles in your metric space and triangles in the Euclidean plane or other constant curvature Riemannian manifolds. And more recently, Gromov in particular, but studied the space of Riemannian manifolds under, let's say, lower Ricci curvature bounds and upper dimension bounds, and they discovered that there's some kind of compactness there, except the limits are not always smooth manifolds anymore. And so I like to think of this as being a little bit like the reals, the rationals, and the real numbers. So the Riemannian manifolds are very beautiful. They're like the rational numbers, but you'd like to be able to close the space. And the limiting objects are not always smooth manifolds anymore, and so you'd like to be able to develop a calculus for the limiting objects. You'd like to be able to treat things like the boundary of the cube in the same way that you treat the boundary of the sphere and the torus, or the donut. Sectional curvature bounds, as I say, go back about 80 years, but it's a more recent development in the last 25 years to be able to make sense of Ricci bounds in such a setting. But of course, in Einstein's theory of gravity, both Ricci curvature plays a central role in the Einstein field equation. Sectional curvatures are also important because they represent tidal forces. And so what I want to talk about today is to what extent we're developing a theory to do something similar in Lorentzian geometry. And I have a bunch of references. But anyhow, before I talk about non-smooth geometry, let me give you a crash course in smooth geometry, just so we're all, which maybe I don't need to do with this audience, but so we're all on the same footing. So, you know, you take Rn, you can put the standard Euclidean norm on it, but you can also put this kind of, what I call a hyperbolic norm. And so there's a future cone F that plays a distinguished role. And my norm, all the actions inside there, and I'm conventionally going to take my norm to be minus infinity outside. And of course, with this sign convention, this norm is concave instead of convex, so it satisfies a backwards triangle inequality. Of course, this Minkowski space is going to be my tangent space at each point on the smooth Lorentzian manifolds I want to talk about. And when I have curves, so a vector in here is time-like, a vector along the boundary is null, we're not going to need everything's going to be future pointing, we're not going to need space-like vectors and so on. If I have a curve on a manifold, I call it time-like if its tangent vectors are all time-like, null, et cetera. I'm going to contrast the Riemannian worlds and the Lorentzian worlds a little bit. So in the Riemannian world, this metric or this norm is a central object, but it's equivalent to knowing the distance between every pair of points on a Riemannian manifold. And you get that by taking an infimum over smooth curves connecting those points. And you can choose any power bigger than or equal to 1. The d that you get out doesn't depend on the power. Because these hyperbolic norms are concave instead of convex, at least with my sign convention, you maximize instead of minimizing. And you get this time separation between any pair of events, x and y. But again, because this is concave, you can raise it to any power less than 1 this time. And my convention is going to be that if y is not in the future of x, I take the time separation to be minus infinity. Extremizers of this action are time-like geodesics. And again, because of the sign conventions, L is going to satisfy the backwards triangle inequality instead of the forwards triangle inequality.
Is that So can I ask, what is the point of introducing Q here?
Okay, so when you do Riemannian geometry, if I minimize this with Q equals 1, then I get the geodesics, but maybe not arc length parametrized. When I take Q bigger than 1, the only minimizers are the arc length parametrized geodesics. So it's a little bit more convenient from a technical point of view. You take something that was not strictly convex and you make it strictly convex. And it's the same point down here. It's more convenient from a technical point of view. That it takes this thing that's concave but linear along rays, and it makes it strictly concave in the interior of the light cone. Other questions? That's gonna haunt us. That Q is gonna haunt us. But
do you want to take limit of Q going to 1?
Yeah, you can take Q equals 1. It's just less technically convenient because then you get other things besides the things you want. Yep.
Particularly in Lorentz geometry, you get preserved because outside the light cone, space might separate, points cannot be connected.
Right, so that's why I take them to have time separation minus infinity, unless y is in the future of x, right? Right, so this supremum effectively is taken only over causal curves, future-directed causal curves. Thank you. And you need some technical hypotheses if you don't want the infimum to be plus infinity, and the technical hypothesis is global hyperbolicity, which we'll say more about eventually. But perhaps more interesting is that there's this, one of the things that makes Lorentzian geometry harder than Riemannian geometry is that the thing that plays the role of the Laplacian in the Lorentzian geometry is the D'Alembertian. It's a wave operator. And all the techniques that you have based on maximum principle and so on don't apply. And so one of the things that we discovered in this program to do non-smooth geometry is what we hope will be a simplification in the smooth theory. So for me, I'm dealing with this concave Lagrangian for curves. There's a dual Hamiltonian. It's the pth power of a covector where if q is between 0 and 1, then p is negative, because here's the relationship between p and q. And notice that, of course, this Lagrangian jumps to infinity across the boundary of the future cone. Similarly, the Hamiltonian diverges smoothly to infinity. So even in the smooth world, we're already forced to confront this non-smooth behavior at the boundary of the light cone. And let me mention that if you look at this function, this action of a scalar field U, and you take this negative power Hamiltonian here, the extremizers of this action, they don't satisfy the wave equation, but because of the concavity of H, they actually satisfy an equation that's degenerate elliptic. And so at least heuristically, we can do things like give a proof of the Lorentzian splitting theorem using Riemannian techniques by working with this nonlinear but elliptic operator that's the Euler-Lagrange equation of this functional instead of having to work with the D'Alembertian. So we can simplify the proofs of Eschenberg and Galloway because we don't need to go to space like hypersurfaces and argue on the hypersurfaces. We can just argue in the space-time. Yes?
How do you do a Lagrange?
How do I what?
Lagrange transformation between Hamiltonian and Lagrangians.
Yeah, okay, so it's easier. It's more standard to do minus H. So minus H is the supremum of W, V. And this is just the duality pairing. This is a covector, and that's a vector, I guess, plus the Lagrangian.
So you can't transform from one to the
other. L is a function on the tangent space. H is a function on the cotangent space. And maybe the simpler relation is that dH composed with dL is the identity, and vice versa. And dL composed with dH is also the identity. Other questions?
What is Eschenberg-Galloway split?
This says if you have a Lorentzian manifold, and you can have a time and you find a time-like geodesic that's doubly infinite, then it says that geometrically your manifold is actually just a product of some Riemannian manifold and one time-like direction. So it's a very useful dimension reduction technique. Okay, here's my crash introduction to curvature. So if I have two curves two future-directed time-like curves, sigma s and tau t, through the same point, and the difference between their tangent vectors also time-like, then I can compute the time separation between sigma s and tau t, and I find that to leading order, it's given by this norm squared, and then the first correction is the sectional curvature, and all the other corrections are higher order, and the sectional curvature turns out to be quadratic in the two space, and you can polarize it to get the whole Riemann tensor. And then you take the trace of the Riemann tensor, you get the Ricci tensor, you take the trace of that, you get the scalar curvature. Here's the volume associated to G in standard coordinates. Notice that in order to take these traces, I'm using the manifold structure. And so when I move to something non-smooth, I'm going to have to figure out how can I get from the sectional curvatures to the Ricci tensor or something like a Ricci tensor. And okay, here's my, maybe this, sorry, here's my one slide introduction to general relativity. I think of the Einstein field equation as being an equation that says geometry equals physics. So on the one side of the equation at each point in space-time, I have a 4x4 matrix that tells me the flux of all the momenta and energies in the different directions. And on the other side, I have some kind of 4x4 curvature matrix. And what matrix is it? Well, it's the Ricci tensor minus some multiple, the scalar curvature times the metric. And in principle, of course, if I knew the distribution of matter and momentum in the space-time, then I could try to solve this equation for the metric tensor Gij. But often we don't know too much about the matter tensor. And of course, people also, there's a big community of people trying to do solve the initial value problem for the Einstein equation where I would only know the matter tensor and fluxes on a spatial hypersurface, Cauchy surface. But often what Hawking and Penrose did was they said, well, we don't know the details of the physics in the problem, but what we do know is that the stress energy tensor should be non-negative in all future directions. Hawking's strong energy condition is, which doesn't apply the weak energy condition, is the Ricci tensor be non-negative in future directions. And both of these guys imply the null energy condition. This is the hypothesis in the Penrose singularity theorem for stellar collapse. That's the hypothesis in the Hawking theorem for Big Bangs type singularities, where you only ask for this non-negativity in light-like directions. And of course, you could put a non-zero right-hand side, which amounts to having a cosmological constant, at least in the strong energy condition. It won't affect the null energy condition. And so one of the developments to come out of this, of course, here's some crude version of a statement of Hawking's theorem. If you have a space-like hypersurface with a mean curvature bound away from zero and you satisfy the strong energy condition, then you have to have a Big Bang singularity not too far in the past. And there's a non-smooth version of this to come out in this non-smooth theorem in a preprint of Cavaletti and Mondino from a few years ago. Let me skip. There are Euclidean analogs of this that I don't want to talk about. But let me mention that, one thing I can say is we can do a bit more in the Euclidean case than we can do in the Lorentzian case in the sense that we can prove these things in non-smooth settings, and we can even say under additional hypothesis in what cases equality occurs, so when the time bound to the Big Bang singularity becomes sharp. It turns out the ball is one case, but cones are also another case. And here's some version of the Penrose theorem. You have the null energy condition, you have some trapped codimension 2 compact surface and a suitable non-compact Cauchy surface for the space, and then you get finite affine time singularities along some null geodesics. And so one of the open problems maybe motivating this work is whether there's a genuinely non-smooth version of this. So in some sense, what I'm suggesting is maybe if we don't insist on being a manifold, but if we go to something more like a metric space, maybe these won't be singular anymore. Oh, well, we know that's not the case in the Hawking theorem because of Cavaletti and Mondino's result.
Sorry, your definition of singularity and is still based on whether you're geodesically complete.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. And so one of the things I'm going to talk about today is a non-smooth version of the null energy condition, but I can preview it already at the smooth level. So if I'm on a Riemannian manifold, any smooth Riemannian manifold, then if I take k negative enough, I always get a lower bound for the Ricci curvature in terms of the metric. But this can't be true in the Lorentzian setting, because if I had a lower bound of this form, then by taking v to be a null vector, I would automatically satisfy the null energy condition. The Ricci tensor in all null directions would be non-negative. And the observation is that this is not only sufficient, but also necessary, or vice versa. So in other words, exactly what the null energy condition means is that there's some possibly becoming more and more negative as you go farther and farther away, lower bound for the Ricci tensor in terms of the Einstein tensor. So in other words, the null energy condition is equivalent to a variable lower bound on the time-like Ricci tensor. Okay, so I think I'm going to start, unless there are questions, I'm going to start talking about the non-smooth setting. Yes? Yes.
This is very classical.
I'm afraid it's going to be a very classical talk. So I know that it would be much more contemporary to relax all of these energy conditions and look for energy conditions that don't hold in a pointwise sense, but maybe only in an average sense, and so on. And I have nothing to say about that at this point. Okay, so now I'm going to try to talk, revisualize this stuff in a non-smooth setting. So now I want to forget whatever I just said about smooth Lorentzian spacetimes. And I want to start over again with just an arbitrary set M and what I call a time separation function on it, so a binary function. To make my life simple, I'm not going to allow plus infinity to be a value, but you could. But it's going to have to satisfy this backwards triangle inequality, and it's going to have to satisfy this anti-symmetry property that if L is in the future of X and X is in the future of Y rather than X equals Y. And moreover, when you combine these two things, you find out that the time separation function of any event to itself is zero. And the motivating example, let's say, is Minkowski space with the norm that I previously described. And the next motivating example is any smooth, globally hyperbolic Lorentzian spacetime. And as soon as you have such a time separation function L, you can use it to define a causal relation by its non-negativity set and a time-like relation by its positivity set. And these are going to be nested relations. The first guy is a partial order. The second guy is a pre-order. They're both transitive, but the first guy is also reflexive because of the anti-symmetry. And you can now build up the usual causality theory where you can define the causal future of X as the set of all Ys where L is non-negative, and the causal past of Z as the set of all Ys where, now in the first slot, where L is non-negative, and causal diamonds, the intersection of the future of X with the past of Z, and so on. You can do this for sets as well as points, and you can do it using the time-like relation instead of the causal relation, and it would be traditional to call this I instead of J when you move to strict positivity instead of non-negativity. And these guys are called causal diamonds. If X and Z are compact, these guys are called causal emeralds sometimes.
Sorry, what's the difference between the diamond and emerald?
So here I'm taking the future of one event and the past of another event and intersecting them. Here I'm taking the future of a compact set and the past of another compact set and intersecting them. Other questions? In this setting, I'm going to call a path causal if whenever S is less than T, sigma T is in the future of sigma S, and time-like if whenever S is less than T, sigma T is in the time-like future of sigma S. And when you have a causal path, you can define its Lorentzian length, I'm going to adopt this minus sign, by taking a supremum over all partitions of the sum of the lengths between adjacent points in the path. And by the backwards triangle inequality, that's always bigger than the time separation between the endpoints. And what's minimizers of this, I guess, would be called, you might call them geodesics, you might call them L minimizers, length minimizers. And a particular example of a minimizing path is if you can find a path with time-like separated endpoints such that the time separation between any pair of points on the path is proportional to the time separation between the endpoints, and it's parameterized in an affine way, I'm going to call that an L path. And if I plug that into the preceding formula, you find out that L paths minimize this negative Lorentzian length. And of course, not all minimizers will be time-like, nor will they be affinely parametrized, so the L-paths are kind of a preferred class, a special class. And they should play the role that, like, massive particles that are unaffected, that are not affected by outside forces follow these paths in the geometry. Yep.
Is it maximized time, but here you talk about minimized.
So yeah, because I put this minus sign in.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they minimize the negative Lorentzian length. That's right. I mean, I did this because negative L satisfies a forwards triangle inequality, and I like to be able to also put D here, where D is a normal triangle distance. And so if every pair of points that are time-like related have one of these paths connecting them, I'm going to call the space a time-like L-path space. And Kunziger and Zeeman have this non-smooth notion of what it means to be a regular globally hyperbolic Lorentzian length space, and all of these have this property. But for their notion, they need not just a time separation function, they also need a metrizable topology. So I'm going to give you my quick introduction to their theory. Their paper was published in 2019, I think. I start out with a metric space equipped with this metric topology, and I also have a time separation function on it. I'm going to call such a thing a metric space-time. As long as a path is non-constant and causal, I'm going to call it a causal curve if it's actually Lipschitz with respect to the metric. And what does global hyperbolicity mean in this setting? Well, first, global hyperbolicity means that for every compact subset of events, there's a uniform bound on the length, on the d length now, of all causal curves. And the metric space-time is globally hyperbolic if it has this uniform bound property and if every causal diamond in it is compact. I'm afraid there are a lot of definitions on this slide and the next ones.
Intuitive.
So here's the picture of a compact diamond, right? You look at the future of X and the past of Z, and you want this set to be compact. It's playing several roles for you. It's playing the role, I mean, we need some assumption like that would take the place of completeness in a metric space, and this is doing part of that job. And we want a limit curve theorem as well, and this is doing that job. That whenever you take any compact set in your set of events, you look at all the curves there, their d arc length has a uniform bound, so you can extract limits from subsequences.
Sorry, so what does space time look like if it's globally hyperbolic, but it is not non-total person?
You mean what does it look like if, so.
As the last thing.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Take a slab in Minkowski space and identify the top with the bottom. So now you have closed causal curves. So that will violate this length bind.
All right.
But it will still have.
Gets rid of CGCs.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Other questions? Okay, two more definitions. So I'm interested in metric space times where every time-like pair of events have a time-like curve connecting them. D Lipschitz. And I'm going to call it a Lorentzian geodesic space if every causal pair of events have one of these D Lipschitz causal curves that attains the minimum for the Lorentzian length. And now I can say what at least in this globally hyperbolic setting, for a globally hyperbolic metric space-time, what does it mean to be a Lorentzian length space? And the answer is you should be time-like curve connected and Lorentzian geodesic, so you should have the two properties above. And moreover, your time separation function should be upper semi-continuous, its positive part should be continuous, and the time-like future and past of each point should be non-empty. So in other words, this definition is modeled on manifolds without space-like boundaries. And in spaces like this, Kunziger and Zeeman actually show that the metric topology coincides with the order topology introduced by the time-like relation. So that although I use this metric D in the definitions, it turns out that the space you get in the end is independent of D. All you need is that the order topology introduced by the time separation is metrizable. And in the smooth setting, there's another characterization of global hyperbolicity, probably the original characterization, which says a space-time is globally hyperbolic if you have a Cauchy surface in it. And it turns out that this is true in the non-smooth setting as well, and that's a recent result of Annegret Bircher and Leonardo Garcia-Heveling from the PhD that he defended last week. However, unfortunately, it turns out that in the abstraction that I've defined this, the L paths may not be continuous. And if you want them to be continuous, you need a little bit more. So you need this extra definition, which I call regular. So a space is regular if every Lorentz length minimizing causal curve that has vanishing length on some non-constant interval, in fact, is light-like, in fact, is globally light-like. And it turns out that this is enough to imply that L paths are continuous. And so then you get this nice corollary that says, if with this extra assumption, every L path is in fact can be reparametrized in a de Lipschitz way and is minimizing, and conversely, every L minimizing de Lipschitz curve can be reparametrized to be an L path, which is kind of what you want.
So you're still thinking that it's a continuous manifold?
No.
No?
It's not a manifold. It's just a set with a time separation function on it and a topology.
But then you said this, whatever the first line is, another regular localizable.
Right. So it's an MDL, and the topology comes from here, and the geometry comes from here.
But you said L path is continuous. If the manifold is not continuous, the L path is continuous.
It's a metric space with a metric on it. And the L paths are continuous with respect to that metric.
Okay.
So it's not. It doesn't need to be a manifold.
So the bottom line from Penrose theorem is the one of the geodesics. And inside the you have to converge to a point. That point is singular. So how do you avoid this?
We don't know whether it's possible to avoid this yet or not. And we don't have an analog of the Penrose theorem in this setting, although it's plausible to believe that such...
Do you avoid singularities?
We don't know. So potentially. Potentially there are some singularities you can avoid and others that you can't. And the question, the question is whether the null geodesics or the time-like geodesics actually explore these singularities or not.
So you use the word localizable.
Yes.
Localizable.
Yeah, so I'm connecting this with jargon from the paper of Kunziger and Zeman. They call it regularly localizable. It's a very technical thing, but I've been able to sidestep all, their paper is very difficult to read, and the definition that I gave you on a couple of slides back, this definition, so I call it a theorem. The theorem is that this definition is equivalent to their definition, and I avoid a lot of the technicalities that go into their definition by doing it this way. And so, yeah, so what does regularly localizable mean to them? It means that every point has a shrinking sequence of neighborhoods, and something nice happens on those neighborhoods.
Is something non-local about
that? Well, again, it's a local condition because it says every event has a sequence of neighborhoods shrinking to it, such that you have nice geodesics in those neighborhoods. It's like a convex neighborhood theorem. It's in the smooth setting, you would think of it as asserting the existence of causally convex neighborhoods, arbitrarily small for every event.
Yes, but I'm trying to understand that to what extent, but you're describing a causal sets, which are.
Right. Right, so that's an excellent question.
I'm thinking this first one doesn't, this regular localizable.
What I'm more worried about, I mean, it may. So I haven't really thought through the connection with causal theory as well as I would like to have. I mean, certainly by the time we get to curvature bounds, the kinds of curvature bounds I'm going to talk about are not going to apply, at least not in the way that I state them in causal set theory, because my discussion is going to be based on geodesics. In causal set theory, you need to go to something like epsilon approximate geodesics. You need to find sequences of points that, which are geodesic up to an error tolerance epsilon.
So basically, for causal set theories, it's basically discretizing space.
Absolutely.
So are you doing that?
No, because my story relies on these L paths, existence of these L paths. And if you wanted to discretize space, you would need to replace the definition of an L-path with something discrete that looks like an L-path up to a small error tolerance. And I don't think anyone has thought about that, and at least no one I know has thought about that in much detail. Maybe the causal set theorists have thought about it.
Yeah, but in the case that you use that frame that you take the epsilon zero when they come out.
Then you'll get this. Exactly. That's how it should work. And people have thought about these epsilon geodesics and so on in the positive signature context. So that's certainly something that one could look at in the Lorentzian signature context. Okay. So for the rest of the talk, I'm going to mostly be thinking about these metric spacetimes, which are closed Lorentzian geodesic subsets of the nice guys, the globally hyperbolic regular Lorentzian length spaces. In such a setting, we have the existence of time-like geodesics. So
push this up.
Yeah.
There are
yeah, I'm going to push it up. Thanks. So whenever I have a sequence of events, x, y, and z, in the time-like future of each other, I know there are geodesics joining those events, and there'll be a geodesic here as well. Sorry, I'll draw it in like this. I can find a comparison triangle in, say, Minkowski space, where this length and that length are the same as this length and that length, and this guy too. And then I can ask, if I pick a midpoint here and look at the geodesic connecting them, is it longer than the corresponding geodesic in Minkowski space? And if the answer is yes, for every time-like triangle, then I would say that this has a time-like sectional curvature lower bound of zero. And if this guy was shorter for every time-like triangle, I would say it has a time-like sectional curvature upper bound of zero. And if my comparison space was de Sitter or anti-de Sitter, I could say what it means for my space to have a lower bound or upper bound on its time-like sectional curvatures of some other constant.
And is it clear in that construction that that suits it? It is always possible to geodesics when you could have given away smoothness. Is it obvious that there will always be geodesics?
Well, okay, so I mean, I had this, globally hyperbolic regular Lorentzian length spaces have the property that every pair of points admits a Lorentzian geodesic between them, or even an L-path. And again, if you wanted to really give away, if you wanted to do discrete things, you need to replace that by epsilon L-paths instead. Okay. And I mean, you can relax one of these to be just causal if you want. Of course, you'll only have geodesics between pairs of points that are causally related. There's no notion of space-like geodesic in this theory. And one of the things that they show is if you have these sectional curvature bounds, then your space is not time-like branching. And what does it mean to be time-like non-branching? It means for every pair of L paths, if they coincide on their middle interval, then they coincide globally. So you can't have two geodesics that go along together and then split. Okay, so it turns out this non-smooth theory is kind of 5 years old, but it turns out consistency of these definitions with the smooth case have been known for about 20 years or 15 years. Rather recently, people have shown that you can take certain kinds of limits of these spaces and that these sectional curvature bounds survive limits. And also recently, this group of three graduate students and a more senior scientist have shown that under this time-like sectional curvature bound, you have a geometric splitting of the kind, the Galloway-Eschenberg kind, except here the hypothesis is stronger because it's time-like sectional curvature bound, not a time-like Ricci curvature lower bound of zero.
So you're talking about curvature. Are you defining curvature?
So I don't define curvature, I only define curvature bounds.
How can I have a bound if I don't know how to define a curvature?
Well, because you're what it means to have a curvature lower bound of zero is that for every time-like triangle, you take all the midpoints, you compare them to the triangle with the same lengths in Minkowski space, and they're always longer. Yeah. And what I want to move on to is how would I define a Ricci lower curvature bound? So having told you what a sectional curvature lower bound means. And it turns out Ricci's a little bit harder. So in the smooth setting, you know, you would look at all triangles with a given side length, and you'd fix the one side, and you'd average the sectional curvature over all the other overall possibilities for the other side, and that would give you the Ricci curvature. But in this kind of non-manifold setting, you don't know how to average. And so you need some additional information that tells you how to average, which is basically to say you need a measure on the manifold, and then you can use the measure to average. And so let me say how this works in positive signature before I say how it works in Lorentzian signature. So this is my slide where I give a crash introduction to optimal transport, which is actually the area that I come at this from. So, but the idea is that I have geodesics between every pair of events in my space. Now I want to explore the nearby geodesics. So what I want to do is fuzz the events out. I want to replace each event by a probability measure, perhaps localized near the event. And then I want to construct a geodesic of probability measures that interpolates between those two probability measures and explore how spread out is that fuzz in the middle of the geodesic of probability measures. So how do you do it? This is my notation for the space of Borel probability measures, compactly supported. I'm going to look at joint measures with given left and right marginals, joint probability measures. And in the metric space setting, you can lift the distance from points to a distance between measures by trying to pair two measures as efficiently as possible with respect to any pth power. P is at least one here. You take the pth root. It turns out that if the underlying metric space is complete and separable, then the set of probability measures that don't grow too quickly at infinity will again be complete and separable, and this will be a distance on them. And it turns out if there are geodesics between every pair of points down in the space, then there'll be dp geodesics between every pair of compactly supported probability measures. So this is a construction for lifting the geometry from points to fuzzy points. And I want to do the same thing with L. I want to lift the geometry from events in space-time to fuzzy events in space-time. And so I'm going to have a very similar definition to this one. Why should this have anything to do with curvature? If I interpolate between this fuzzy point and that fuzzy point, if I'm on the sphere, the fuzz will be bigger in the middle than it was at the endpoints. If I'm on a saddle, it'll be less fuzzy. And so I can see the non-negative Ricci curvature of the sphere by the amount of fuzz, or the Ricci non-positive curvature of the saddle. OK, so if I want to do this with L instead of D, I need to focus my attention on joint measures having given left and right marginals, which are vanish outside the causal relation, or perhaps even vanish outside the time-like relation. And among such joint measures, I try to maximize the expected qth power of the L distance and then take a qth root. And it turns out that if the underlying space-time is Polish globally hyperbolic regular Lorentzian length space, then the set of probability measures becomes a time-like LQ path space with this. So in other words, I've succeeded in lifting my geodesics from events to fuzzy events. Unfortunately, not all of these LQ paths, which are like geodesics of probability measures, are even going to be continuous for the topology from the preceding page. And so you need a little extra technical hypothesis to make sure they're continuous. And it's a restriction on the initial and the final fuzz. If I let gamma super q be the set of maximizers in this problem, what I want is that at least one of them vanishes outside the time-like relation. And I call that time-like q-dualizability. The pair is time-like q-dualizable if this happens. And if all of the maximizers actually vanish outside the time-like relation, or if there's a unique maximizer and it's time-like q-dualizable, I call it strongly time-like q-dualizable. This is terminology of Cavaletti and Mondino.
What does the Polish thing mean? That's the topology.
Yeah, it means that the topology can be metrized in such a way that it's complete and separable.
Why do you call that way?
It's terminology the probabilists use. So basically, what it means is that your underlying measure space looks measure theoretically like the unit interval. So it has, there's a countable dense set.
Yeah, but by Polish,
it's Polish and not Polish.
It's Polish, it's capital P.
Yeah.
I mean, it was probably worked out by people from the Banach School, so that's probably why it's called Polish.
That's what I was wondering.
Yeah?
As in Poland.
As in Poland, yes.
But this is Lorentzian now, right?
Yep.
So this is Lorentzian.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry. Actually, I think that the main problem with the Lorentzian, at the is the way I enter to think about it is that there is no clear notion of fuzziness. Because, I mean, at least in terms of if you want to fuzz out a point, there could be everything as along the light point away from that point, it's zero distance from it. So
well,
what do we mean by fuzzy?
Okay, so I want to focus on events where y is in the time-like future of x.
Yeah.
And then I can fuzz x a little bit, and I can fuzz y a little bit.
Can you be clear? So what do you mean by fuzz?
I mean, take a sequence of probability measures which converge to a delta measure at x in the limit.
Yeah.
And take a sequence of probability measures nu that converge to a delta measure at y.
Yeah.
And then I want to restrict the support of these measures so that the support, the simplest restriction would be the support of mu cross nu is actually contained in the set where L is positive. So that then every event here is time-like related to every event there.
Okay.
So if you fuzz it out, you never get light-like.
I never get light-like, exactly. In fact, you start out by doing this, and then by approximation, you can handle a little bit of light-like as long as it's measure zero.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And in fact, the whole point of the time-like Q-dualizable definition on the preceding page, maybe I should put it up again, is that for these guys, you avoid light-like. Or at least the light-like events are measure zero. Okay. Right, and so the metric space-time becomes a metric measure space-time if you have a Borel non-negative measure on it that's finite on bounded subsets. It's called Polish if it's complete and separable, and proper if every bounded subset is compact. And the typical example is a smooth globally hyperbolic Lorentzian manifold. But I want to do this funny thing where the reference measure doesn't need to be the Lorentzian volume. It can be multiplied by a weight. And this comes up in various places like near horizon geometry of black holes, these weights. They also come up when you take certain limits of unweighted spaces, what are called collapsed limits. So those guys which are globally hyperbolic Lorentzian but have a weight in front of them are sometimes called smooth metric measure spacetimes. I hope to have time still to talk about Ricci bounds. I guess I do a little bit. So I needed to measure how fuzzed out things are in the middle of my geodesic probability measures. And I'm going to measure that fuzzing relative to this reference measure M using kind of a Boltzmann-Shannon sort of entropy. So if my measure is absolutely continuous with respect to M, I do integral rho log rho. And if it's not, my entropy is plus infinity. My sign convention is upside down from the usual one in the physics literature. So in other words, my entropy is going to be low if things are very spread out instead of being high if they're very spread out. And more or less, what I want to say is that the Ricci curvature is going to be non-negative if this entropy is convex along every geodesic of probability measures. That was somehow the picture we saw in the sphere. And so here's a definition that does this. It's easiest to parse this definition in the case there's going to be a curvature parameter and a dimension parameter. It's easiest to parse when the curvature parameter is zero and the dimension parameter is infinity. And in that case, the right-hand side here vanishes, and so I'm asking for convexity of some function h of t. And what is h of t? Well, it's the relative entropy along a geodesic of probability measures relative to the reference measure. And if you want non-zero curvature, then you ask for the lower bound to be larger or smaller than zero. And if you want a finite upper bound on your dimension, then you ask for the convexity to be enhanced by this first order term. And so depending on whether this holds for all only strongly time-like dualizable or all time-like Q dualizable pairs of endpoints, this is called TCD, time-like curvature dimension, with parameters k, n, and q, or weak time-like curvature dimension with parameters k, n, and q. And what's one of the points is that if you, Cavaletti and Mundino propose a topology such that all limits of these time-like curvature dimension spaces with certain parameters are again time-like curvature dimension with the same parameters. Well, there's this difference between strong and weak, but if the spaces are all time-like non-branching, then you could take this to be weak. And I'm going to tell you their notion of convergence. It's based on Gromov-Hausdorff convergence in the positive signature case. But here it is. So you have a sequence of space time, of metric measure space times. The sequence is parameterized by J. You pick a distinguished point in the support of each of the measures. And then I say that converges in the pointed measured sense to a limit if I can embed the whole sequence and the limit into one giant metric space time, globally hyperbolic regular Lorentzian length space, such that the distinguished points converge and the measures converge weakly against continuous compactly supported test functions. So it's somehow a very weak, very flexible notion of convergence. But nevertheless, it's strong enough to ensure that if your sequence has these time-like curvature, lower curvature, upper dimension bounds, then your limit has the same time-like lower curvature, upper dimension bounds. And this is technical, and I don't want to fuss about it. Here's the statement that this is consistent with how we think of curvature in the classical case. And here, it's if you're going to look at weighted Lorentzian volumes, then it's useful to define this augmented Ricci tensor, where I add the Hessian of the exponential weight and maybe subtract a first-order term. And so the smooth metric measure space-time satisfies this time-like curvature dimension bound with parameters k and n, if and only if it's classically Ricci lower bounded by k, and its topological dimension is smaller than or equal to the dimension parameter. And if it's strictly small, if it's equal, I need to use the original Ricci curvature. If it's strictly smaller, I can use this weighted Bakri-Emery tensor. You can also, the upper bounds are not so good because they don't survive limits, but there's a version of upper bounds as well due to Mundino and Suhr. Here's the picture that I showed you before from Villani's book. You can also use other entropies to define this notion. If the spaces are time-like non-branching, the definition you get turn out to be equivalent. So you don't need to use rho log rho, you can use various powers of rho. And one of the questions Cavaletti Mondino asked is, can you give a synthetic formulation of the null energy condition, which is more widely satisfied than the strong, I mean, it's physically satisfied, whereas the strong energy condition need not be. And it's the hypothesis in the Penrose theorem. And so that I want to answer in the last couple of minutes. And here's a theorem that kind of answers it. Well, I foreshadowed it already. So this is a very general theorem. It works in any signature, actually. But a null lower bound on any smooth tensor field, symmetric tensor field, is equivalent to a time-like lower bound, except that the time-like lower bound gets more and more negative as you go farther and farther away. So on each compact subdomain of the manifold, you should have a time-like lower bound. And you can use this as the basis for a synthetic theory of having null lower curvature bounds of zero and upper dimension bounds of n by basically asking for each compact subset of your space-time, the emerald generated by that convex subset should satisfy time-like curvature dimension bounds with some k that depends on the compact set. And in the last minute, I want to give you an example showing that this is not stable. So, okay, I mentioned already that in this TCD 0n setting, there's a Hawking theorem. It would be nice to know whether there's a Penrose theorem in this null curvature dimension setting. But let me say you don't really expect stability because unless these lower bounds are somehow uniform in J, they could drop off to minus infinity as J goes to infinity. And I want to show you an example where that happens. It's a little bit, it's not exactly the example I'd like to have, but it's the example I have at the moment. So you take a slab of Minkowski spacetime, cut off between the time coordinate lies between minus 1 and 1. And I take the usual Minkowski metric on it, and I take a basis and take the Euclidean metric as well to define a distance and a time separation. And then what measure do I put on it? I want to put a measure, so I can do this in two dimensions. The origin plays a distinguished role, where most of the mass is in the future and past of the origin, and very little of the mass is in the elsewhere of the origin. And where this becomes more and more exaggerated along the sequence. So as J gets larger and larger, the measure concentrates more and more in the future and past of the origin and less in the elsewhere. And so each of these guys, for any finite J, each of these guys satisfies the null energy condition with no dimension bound. So you compute this weighted Ricci curvature. The ordinary Ricci curvature of Minkowski space vanishes, but the part that comes from the weight here has a minus J in front of it. And if n was finite, I would have this term that screws things up, so I take n to be infinite. And then this has a lower bound of minus j, but as I let j go to infinity, the lower bound drops off. And what happens in the limit is, along the sequence, the support of the probability measure is the whole space. But in the limit, the support of the probability measure is just two Dirac masses. I normalize these to be probability measures. So in the limit, I get a disconnected topology where all of the masses here or here vanishes everywhere in between. And so this kind of thing can't happen under a time-like curvature dimension bound because of Cavalletti and Mondino's theorem. Under a time-like curvature dimension condition, the support of the limit would always be time-like geodesic connected. Here it isn't. And I think maybe that's a fair place for me to stop. So here's a list of references. Thank you very much for your attention.
Sorry, I keep asking questions.
That's OK. Questions are good.
Sorry, classical general relativity. If a star is massive enough, it satisfies the possibility conditions that the star collapses, how right it falls to the future null to infinity. Bundles of geodesics have to go to a singularity.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So your smooth electricity, as I saw that problem, do you still get this singularity?
This is an excellent question, and I think that the answer is this open question that I tried to highlight on this page. And so the answer is that if you're a smooth spacetime with a metric tensor which maybe only C1, then yes, you still get the same scenario. And that's the best result I know. So it's not terribly non-smooth because it's still a manifold.
It's not terribly non-singular. What does that mean?
I said it's not terribly non-smooth. But you still get geodesic incompleteness. And I should say that in the very smooth setting, there is an argument for Penrose's singularity theorem based on the kinds of tools that I described, entropic convexity along certain kinds of geodesics of probability measures. But it's not clear, that's a preprint that showed up earlier this year by my former postdoc. It's not clear that this argument can be made to work in the non-smooth setting that I described today.
So if you see infinity, you still get the standard black hole.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. This is in fact the standard result with a new proof. And this is a less standard result because the metric tensor is not smooth enough to define curvatures in the classical way.
You would think if it's non-smooth, it would be worse, right? But it's not clear.
Well, if it's non-smooth, you might hope that, you might hope not to get the geodesic. I mean, you have more flexibility. So you might have these kind of non-smooth, but still L paths existing. But so far, we haven't seen that.
So I guess one kind of scenario one may imagine is that there is some sort of a membrane effect in time, and then on the other side there is another manifold, and you cannot take derivatives across it, but you can measure distances across it.
So right. I mean, that's time separations.
Yeah, time separation. Right. So in some sense, maybe one exercise that can be actually stitch two different space time.
Exactly.
Across some boundary.
Right. And this exercise has been done in the positive signature case by Ketterer, and nobody's attempted anything like it in the Lorentzian signature case.
So the only way to avoid singularities, there are two possibilities. One is quantum gravity.
Yes.
And the other is modified gravity. If you modify gravity, then you can get a theory with no singularity.
What's
the main goal of this problem? So this is so far, correct me if I'm wrong, kinematics.
It's so far what?
Kinematics. Like,
yep.
Whether it is not
right.
Smooth structure, how can we try to find what we hope is the closest to what we know in differential manifolds?
Right.
So eventually, do you kind of foresee a way to perhaps try and study with the future evolution of something that would be right?
Sure. So for example, there are these inextendability results of certain geometries, like Jan Spiersky has, which says, you know, for example, Minkowski space cannot be extended. But it can't be extended in the manifold setting, but maybe it can be extended in some other setting. Or Schwarzschild cannot be extended, but maybe it can be extended in a less smooth setting. That would be the hope. That would be a hope.
That's a hope, but would you also include even this initial configuration and try and build up the space time to feature it?
Well, you could. Yeah, you could try to do that. And I mean, so I don't know. I know very little about the initial value formulation, but occasionally it is useful to relax. I mean, so a very general theme in partial differential equations is that you don't start out looking for, it's not fruitful to start out looking for solutions in smooth spaces. You often, if you want compactness and so on, it's much better to relax the smoothness of space and show that some kind of non-smooth solution exists. And the holy grail in partial differential equations, nonlinear differential equations, is to find a relaxed notion of solution, which is relaxed enough that solutions exist, but strict enough that solutions are unique when you expect them to be unique, but then you don't necessarily always expect them to be smooth. So in fluids you get shocks and so on. And so it might be profitable, I have no idea, to use this kind of relaxation as a more flexible setting in which to build solutions and to hope to cook up a notion of solution which is permissive enough that they exist and restrictive enough that they're unique under the conditions where you expect them to be unique. And still permit singularities like shocks to form.
Okay, any other questions? Not, let's thank Robert once again.